On the 12th of September, the rival commanders of Stalingrad flew simultaneously to see their respective supremos. As von Paulus met the Führer, Zhukov and Vasilevsky were on their way to see their Wurst. Stalin was presented with a report proposing further offensives, to grind down the enemy and simultaneously to prepare a more powerful blow. But what? Stalin looked at his own map and studied it quietly, ignoring the soldiers for a long moment, lost in his thoughts. Zhukov and Vasilevsky retreated from the green baize table, talking to one another in low voices. There might be some other solution. "And what does another solution mean?" asked Stalin suddenly, raising his head. "I never thought he had such a keen ear," noted Zhukov. Before the generals could answer, Stalin added, "Go over to the general staff and think over carefully what must be done. We'll meet here at 9 tomorrow night." Victory has many fathers, and many claimed paternity for Stalingrad, but it was really the child of the unique collaboration between Stalin, Vasilevsky, and Zhukov, all gifted in their own ways. The next evening, Stalin welcomed the commanders back to his study with an unusual gesture, a handshake. "Well, what have you come up with?" They handed over their map, which showed their basic plan to launch a massive offensive against the German flanks, held by the weaker Romanian forces, smashing into their rear and linking up to encircle them. Operation Uranus. Just at this moment, back in Stalingrad, the German attack descended on the embattled 62nd Army. Paskryobyshev entered Stalin's study. Yeryomenko was on the line from Stalingrad. Chuikov was just maintaining his bare-knuckle grip on the west bank of the Volga. "Send in Zhukov and Vasilevsky straight back to Stalingrad to reconnoitre Uranus," Stalin said portentously. "No one else knows what we three have discussed here. No one beyond the three of us is to know about it for the time being." The little corner was now a quiver with tension. Stalin agonized that the Germans would guess what was afoot. On the 13th, as von Paulus launched a last attempt to dislodge Chuikov, now holding a ruined splinter of territory only 50 yards deep, Zhukov and Vasilevsky flew into Moscow for a final briefing. By the way Stalin smoked his pipe, smoothed his moustache, and never interrupted once, "we could see he was pleased," wrote Zhukov. At 7:20 on the misty morning of the 19th of November 1942, 1,000,000 men, 13,500 guns, 1,400 tanks, and 1,100 planes smashed into Hitler's forces. For 16 hours, Stalin never ceased issuing instructions, talking on the phone, signing papers, calling in Paskryobyshev and giving him orders. He personally drafted every press release, a master of succinct yet rousing phrases such as "blood for blood." While jealously checking the kudos of his generals, he was punctilious in giving them credit for their victories. At midnight, Vasilevsky reported jubilantly from Stalingrad. Hitler's Romanian allies were crumbling. Within 4 days of the launch of Operation Uranus, the German 6th Army, 330,000 men, was encircled in what Stalin called the decisive moment of the war. As the Russians tightened their grip, von Manstein's counterattack failed to break through. The Luftwaffe proved incapable of supplying from the air. The encircled Germans suffered a cruel, slow death from starvation, ice, and dynamite. The Russians counterattacked into Manstein's rear, threatening to cut off Army Group Don and break through towards Rostov. In the little corner, the impatient Stalin chose General Lukasovsky, not the Stalingrad commander Yeryomenko, to oversee the liquidation of the 6th Army. "Why don't you say anything?" he asked Zhukov, who had frowned. "Yeryomenko will be very hurt," replied Zhukov. "It's no time for feeling hurt," said Stalin. "We're not schoolgirls, we are Bolsheviks." Stalin's hours of pressure and work were awesome, but his commissars and generals had invariably been up since dawn, a life that demanded enormous physical and moral resources, with nervous exhaustion a real danger. Stalin legislated their lives, personally decreeing their rota of work and rest. Vasilevsky had to sleep from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m. without fail. Stalin sometimes rang Vasilievsky like a strict nanny to check he was asleep. If he answered the phone, Stalin cursed him. On the 10th of December, Rokossovsky attacked the benighted Germans, slicing their pocket in half. The Sixth Army diminished daily. The military defeat became a human struggle for survival as the Germans ate horse meat, cats, rats, each other, and finally nothing. On the 31st of January, Field Marshal von Paulus surrendered, and 240,000 starving, frostbitten scarecrows, barely recognizable as men, let alone soldiers, became prisoners. Stalin himself wrote out this newsflash. "Today, our armies trapped the commander of the Sixth Army near Stalingrad, with all his staff." Now, a confident, preening Stalin and a gold-braided, bemedaled Imperial Bolshevik Russia emerged, blood-spattered but swaggering with pride, from behind the iron mask of Soviet austerity, to fight their way into Europe. Stalin had overturned the Bolshevik slogan, "Down with the golden shoulder boards," and restored the epaulets and braid of Tsarist officers. He personally instructed the media how to spin it. The gold braid was not just decoration, but also about order and discipline. During the next 2 years, he rarely appeared out of marshal's uniform. Stalin now slightly clipped Beria's powerful wings by bringing military counterintelligence under his own aegis. He renamed it SMERSH, an acronym for Death to Spies, that he coined himself, but kept Abakumov in charge. This slick but vicious secret policeman of 35 had worked closely with Beria, but Stalin, the ultimate patron, now took him under his wing. The unprecedented surrender of a German field marshal humiliated Hitler just as acutely as the capture of his son Yakov exposed Stalin. Both dictators expected these embarrassments to fall on their swords. Count Bernadotte of the Red Cross approached Molotov with an offer to swap Yakov for von Paulus, but Stalin refused to swap a marshal for a soldier. "All of them are my sons," Stalin replied like a good Tsar, telling Svetlana, "War is war." A few weeks later, in a POW camp near Lübeck, Yakov, who courageously refused to cooperate with the Germans, committed suicide by throwing himself onto the camp wire. Stalin did not find out the truth for some years, but when he did, he regarded his son with pride. He ordered the release of Yakov's wife, Julia, though she returned damaged by the trauma. Like Nadia, Yakov forever troubled him. Stalin now received a letter from the leading documentary filmmaker, Roman Karmen, that denounced Vasily for the seduction of Karmen's wife. Vasily was back in Moscow, living at Zubalova, which he turned into a pleasure dome of drinking, dancing, and womanizing. The Tsarevich's set were glamorous film stars, screenwriters, pilots, ballerinas, and freeloaders, at the center of which were Karmen and his beautiful actress wife, Nina. The fun at Vasily's orgies was often rather desperate. He was permanently drunk, and often hit his wife, Galina, who had recently given birth to their son, Alexander. He was always drawing his revolver and firing at the chandeliers with his daredevil friends. Frustrated by Stalin's ban on his active missions, reckless of his own safety and that of his companions, Vasily enjoyed flying planes, drunk. When he wanted to show off to his sister's pretty friend, Marta Pieshkova, he insisted on flying her to see Svetlana in Kuibyshev. "He flew me legless, and with a drunk crew," she recalls. "Even though there was ice on the wings, they drank the spirit instead of using it for de-icing so the plane would not keep its height. Finally, we had to crash land and glided into a haystack in a clearing." Marta was terrified. Vasily hiked to the nearest collective farm, from where he dispatched a rescue mission and was feted in the local party chairman's house. He was so drunk that the chairman's wife locked Marta in her room to protect her. Even his friend, Vladimir Mikoyan, killed at Stalingrad, complained of Vasily's drinking willfulness and outbursts of rudeness. What a cretin! Svetlana, 16, living between the sterile austerity of the Kremlin apartment and the vapid degeneracy of Zubalova, felt lonely and unappreciated both by her busy father and her unpleasant brother. but this freckled redhead had matured early into a curvaceous, intelligent and sensitive girl who resembled Stalin's mother and possessed much of her father's obstinacy and toughness. At one of Vasily's parties, Svetlana met a handsome, worldly and famous screenwriter named Alexei Kapler. He was a suave and mesmerizing raconteur and Casanova, though married. To the clever but brooding Svetlana, he was like a character out of one of her Dumas novels. "Can you do the foxtrot?" he asked. Svetlana felt awkward in her flat shoes, but Kapler assured me I was a good dancer. I was wearing my first good dress from a dressmaker with an old garnet brooch of my mother's. She trusted him. "Why are you so unhappy today?" he asked. Svetlana explained that it was 10 years to the day since my mother's death, yet no one seemed to remember. The two were irresistibly drawn to one another. It was wartime, and we reached out to each other. He lent her adult books and poetry about love, which helped overcome her fear of the vulgarity of sex about which Vasily constantly told her. Their relationship was passionate, but never fully sexual. "A kiss, that's all," remembered Kapler. Yet it was thrilling for Svetlana. "Romantic and pure, I was brought up that sex was only for marriage," she revealed later. But the war had changed everything. At any other time, Kapler might have thought the better of seducing Stalin's only daughter, but I thought she really needed me. This charismatic womanizer was moved by Svetlana's plight, but he also reveled in his new adventure. He was dispatched to cover Stalingrad for Pravda, filing his Letters of Lieutenant L. from Stalingrad, in which he daringly paraded his affair with the words, "It's probably snowing in Moscow. You can see the crenellated wall of the Kremlin from your window." The cognoscenti were amazed at the folly of taunting a vindictive Georgian father on the front page of Pravda, but to Svetlana this was staggering in its chivalry and recklessness. The moment I saw it, I froze, but I sensed the whole thing might come to a terrible end. When Kapler returned, Svetlana begged him not to see her, but, as he said, "I don't remember who suggested the risk of that heart-rending farewell." They met in an empty apartment near Kursk station, where Vasily's pals had assignations. Her bodyguard, Klimov, sat anxiously next door. Beria had already informed Stalin, who warned Svetlana in a tone of extreme displeasure that I was behaving in a manner that could not be tolerated, but he blamed Vasily for corrupting her. Stalin dismissed his son as Air Force inspector for conduct unbecoming and posted him to the Northwest Front. Vlasik, Stalin's domestic panjandrum, suggested Kapler leave Moscow. Kapler told him to go to hell, but arranged an assignment away from the city. On the 2nd of March, Kapler was bundled into a car which was followed by a sinister black Packard, in which General Vlasik sat, looking very important. At the Lubyanka, Vlasik supervised his sentencing for anti-Soviet opinions to 5 years in Vorkuta. The next day, already under pressure as Manstein's counter-offensive retook Kharkov and threatened the success of Stalingrad, Stalin was so angry he got up hours earlier than usual. Svetlana was getting dressed for school when Stalin strode briskly into her bedroom, something he had never done before. He was choking with anger, nearly speechless. Where are they all?" he sputtered. "Where are all these letters from your writer? I know the whole story. I've got all your telephone conversations right here." He tapped his tunic pocket. "All right, hand them over. Your Kapler's a British spy. He's under arrest." Svetlana surrendered Kapler's letters and screenplays, but shouted, "But I love him." "Love?" shrieked Stalin, with hatred of the very word, and for the first time in her life slapped her twice across the face. Then he turned to her nanny. "Just think, nurse, how low she's sunk. Such a war going on, and she's busy fucking." "No, no, no," the nanny tried to explain, fat hands flapping. "What do you mean, no?" Stalin asked more calmly. "When I know the whole story." Then to Svetlana, "Take a look at yourself. Who'd want you, you fool? He's got women all around him." Stalin gathered up the letters and took them into the dining room, where he sat at the table where Churchill had dined, and, ignoring the war altogether, started to read them. He did not appear at the little corner that day. That afternoon, when Svetlana returned from school, Stalin was waiting for her in the dining room, tearing up Kepler's letters and photographs. "Writer," he sneered, "he can't even write decent Russian." She couldn't even find herself a Russian. Kepler's Jewishness especially riled him. She left the room, and they did not speak again for many months. Their loving relationship was shattered forever. On the northwestern front, Vasily's outrages continued. In May, he set off on a drunken fishing expedition in which the pilots caught fish by tossing aircraft rockets into a pond. One of the rockets killed a hero of the Soviet Union. On the 26th of May, Stalin ordered Air Force Commander Novikov to announce that Colonel Stalin is dismissed for hard drinking, debauchery, and corrupting the regiment. But it was impossible to keep a dictator's son down. By the end of the year, the scapegrace had once again been promoted, and he was soon driving his Rolls-Royce along the front, borrowing official planes whenever it suited him. As for Svetlana, she was soon in love with someone whose name was so dreaded that, in two published memoirs and many interviews over 50 years, she has still never revealed his identity. Not until March 1943, shortly after the Kepler affair, did Stalin finally contain Manstein's counterattack, leaving a swollen Soviet salient bulging into the German lines around Kursk. Hitler approved Operation Citadel to cut off the bulge. Stalin's instincts were always to attack, but Zhukov and Vasilievsky managed to persuade him to wait and break the Germans in a defensive position. Stalin had learned the great lesson of Stalingrad. He took their advice on what would become the world's greatest tank battle, Kursk. Zhukov and Vasilievsky rushed to the front to plan the battle. Malyenkov supervised the generals. Mikoyan amassed the reserves. Beria provided 300,000 slave laborers to dig an unbreachable 3,000 miles of trenches. Over 1 million men and 6,000 tanks waited. At dawn on the 5th of July, the Germans threw 900,000 men and 2,700 tanks into the colossal battle of machines in which fleets of metallic giants clashed helm to helm, barrel to barrel. By the 9th, the Germans had reached their limit. On the 12th, Zhukov unleashed the costly but highly successful counterattack. The Battle of Kursk was the climax of the Panzer era, the mechanized equivalent of hand-to-hand combat, which left a graveyard of 700 tanks and burnt flesh. Hitler had lost his last chance to win the war.